Okay. Jeremiah of Region 2, I got to meet a year ago when I went to Virginia for their Region 7 assembly. And Jeremiah was my first encounter with a region chair. And Jeremiah and Alice, and he, let's see if I can find the words, he made me feel just completely welcome. And I got to just be who I am, which is a wonderful thing. And he got a car and he took care of us all weekend long, including taking us out to dinner and all those amazing things. And so Jeremiah will always have a special place in my heart because he was the first region chair that I got to interact with. But I got to hear a tiny little bit of his story, and I've always wanted to hear more because he's a precious soul. And so when they asked me who would I suggest for the speaker tonight, I said, well, actually, Jeremiah would be awesome. So on that note, I'm going to shut up and just welcome him up here to share his story.
Howdy, Oklahoma. Thank you for that. I appreciate that. Overhead lighting is hellacious. That is not the introduction I wrote for you. I knew she was going to get a little sappy and I didn't want to follow that, but we'll redo it next time. I did not come to OA for recovery. I came because I was obsessed. I was obsessed about my body. I was obsessed about food. I was obsessed about my pride. I was obsessed about my performance. But most urgently, I came to OA for a boy. True story. So let's go back to January of 2010. I was living in Seattle. And January 2010 has a remarkable distinction of being the warmest January on record ever. And my 400 pounds felt every bit of that humidity. I was 23 and I was living on the 16th floor of a condo that I could barely afford. And I was surrounded by the trappings of a life that was built with ego and ambition. And it was slowly all unraveling. At the time, I was serving on the board of directors for a recovery center in Seattle. And why? Because I was paid to do it. There was this lovely little benefit where we were paid to volunteer, and it was really easy for me to get there. And so that's why I chose it. And so I did it for a few months, and it just happened to overlap with one of their OA meetings. And I saw you come in and walk past me, say hello to me, and you went into your little meeting. And then an hour or so later, you would come back out. And I didn't see the transformation. I didn't see God. I saw broken bodies. I saw old people. I saw women. I saw you, but I didn't see myself. OA for me was not the last house on the block because I wasn't given the gift of desperation. I didn't go because it was somewhere where I thought that I could belong. I kept coming back because maybe he would come back. But it turns out this boy was on a short-term work assignment, just finding a local OA meeting, and he never did come back. But something else did. Something just a little bit quieter. Something that didn't demand anything of me. Something that didn't demand a performance. I didn't understand it in those first few weeks, but I certainly felt it. It's as if something in that room just whispered, "You can start over." And so I stayed. I'm trying to purposefully not speak fast. My name is Jeremiah, and I'm a food addict. It's very powerful to say that in such a huge room like this. I am a food addict. My abstinence date is that date, January 7th, 2010. I have not taken a single compulsive bite of anything, not once since that night. Pretty remarkable. Yeah. My home group is the Thursday night commitment to abstinence meeting in San Francisco, and my virtual home group is the Tuesday night game ins meeting affiliated with the virtual intergroup. I am sponsored and I am a sponsor. I do service, and today I consider myself in the center of the lifeboat. I have See, I wasn't nervous until someone said frickin', and someone said I didn't want to say the F word, and then someone said thank you for not because I really want to say it now. But I worked really frickin' hard to work off 160 pounds. I brought denim to Oklahoma. Y'all want to see this? This is the gift of my program. I've lost a Keckner. Does that relate to anyone? I've lost a Keckner. Mike Keckner, Denver, Colorado. Come on, you guys, Region 3, you have to know Mike Keckner. Yeah, I've lost a Keckner. More importantly than losing this, though, I have gained access to a life that, my friends, I never thought was possible for myself. So, this is what my disease looked like. I used food the way that others use drugs and alcohol, and that's why I identify as a food addict. I rotated through drive-thrus on the regular, numerous drive-thrus every night, making sure to not hit the same one twice and making sure to really calibrate what it was that I was ordering because I was for certain that the person was clocking what I was getting. So I would make sure that the quantity that I would be purchasing would be enough for two people. Maybe not three, but I knew that there was going to be the next place. And so then I could, just the mental games. And I did that every single day. I would binge in dark parking lots. I knew where they were. Or I would take my binge food home and I would draw the shades as if they were ever open, but I would draw the shades. And I would sit down, and my binge food would be splayed on my cocktail table, and I would zone out into a television to escape the reality that I was in and slide into someone else's and just hand to mouth. And that was the life that I lived. I told myself that this was comfort. But that is not comfort. That's anesthesia. I was hospitalized a couple of times. Diverticulitis, that is painful. You feel like your appendix is ruptured. Not once, not twice, three different times. I had my body pumped out because I was poisoning myself from the inside out. I was dying very neatly, very quietly. And that's exactly what my disease wanted. The big book says, we're like men who have lost their legs. They never grow new ones. That's amputated from life. That is me pretending to function. And I wasn't hungry for food, as it turns out. I was just starving. Starving for a little bit of peace. So, what it was like, I lived a double life. I have what we call in my neck of the woods the good boys disease, right? I didn't drink, didn't smoke, I didn't use, I just ate. By day, I was pretty successful. I'm educated, did well in school, privileged enough to be in the right place at the right time to get the good career path. And at night, that person did not exist. I just binged. I remember Monday was my favorite day of the week. Because on Monday, everything was going to change, right? The new shoes secured, the new workout outfit secured, the rowing machine that was $4,500 secured. And then on Monday, I was going to start a new plan, right? The weekend, we don't have to worry about the weekend. The weekend doesn't count. But Monday, everything was going to change. How many Mondays do you think I went through? Because Mondays turned out to be the days where all I did was lie. I lied to myself. I lied to my colleagues and my friends about what I wanted them to think that I did over the weekend because I certainly wasn't hanging out with them because I was binging. So Mondays were the day that I looked forward to and the day that I really solidified being a liar and a manipulator. My secrets started to leak out in really weird ways. I'd get the sweats, my skin, the sheer exhaustion of doing simple walking. 400 pounds on a set of knees does quite a bit of damage. 400 pounds on toes does a lot of damage. It's a practice of self-care now. I get weekly manicures and pedicures. My toenails are beautiful. And they're painted. They are. But I was rotting on the inside and I was smiling through it. It is a freaking weird double-edged coin there. All through the time I was trying to manage this, I was trying to keep myself calm. I knew what I was doing. I'm a smart guy. I knew what I was doing to myself, and I just could not stop. I felt a certain way, good or bad. What was the answer? Eat. And then I felt guilty about what I just done to myself. Said I was going to do it differently. That lapsed. Snake eating its own tail just over and over. And for a long time, I did not trust trying to be calm because calm meant that there was a little bit of silence before something bad was going to happen. And I totally did it to myself. I am someone who lives a life in fear. Fear has been the guiding force of my whole life. It's just my reality. Fear led me to my coping mechanism, which was food. My dad really wanted to be a dad, and my mom really wanted to be an actress. I was born because my mother bowed to the societal pressures of being a woman in the 80s. She did what she felt she had to do. And when I came along, she was done. And quite honestly, now I respect her for it. You know, she did what she wanted to do. But my dad was 22 at the time. And here he is, you know, a guy in the Air Force, single father, taking his basic newborn overseas. What a trip. I'm 38 years old now. I cannot imagine A, being a dad, two, being a dad at 22, and then having the responsibility of taking that kid by myself overseas. What a trip. I did not have a relationship with my mother. I returned to her when my dad went to Kuwait in 1990 to go and serve. And I was 3.5 years old. And I'm going to say something a little shocking, and I'm sorry for this, but my mom had her own quiet desperation. And in mid-August, the authorities found me, and I was tear stained and I was covered in quite a bit of blood splatter. So it's hard because this is the first time that I've ever shared this at a group level. And I don't do it for a shock value, but I do it because it illustrates exactly how it felt in trying to stop eating. It felt unsafe. And for many, many years, my friends, I kept feeding my fear instead of feeling it. When you go through something like that, it recharts the course of the life that you're going to live. And the more that I fed my fear, the hungrier it became. It's so quiet in here. I know this is a convention. I know that this is a time to celebrate. I do. I just want to stress, just like the big book says, we are only as sick as our secrets, right? That is not poetic. It is diagnostic. And secrecy for me is not safety. It is its own version of a slow suicide. And that is not what I want for my life, right? So that antidote for me is sunlight and oxygen. And now I have turned it over. So I'm someone who grew up pretty afraid of God. I carried the guilt, of what happened that night with me, and I probably will forever. For me, God has always been this cosmic judge who was up in the sky and has this little clipboard, and he's making tally marks against me, right? sort of just hash marking all of my sins. I'm sure he's got a few volumes now. But as a gay kid growing up, man, that had a profound effect on me, right? I was terrified by the entity that is God. I prayed myself to be different. I did not want to be this way. I thought that by being who I am, I was disqualified from receiving grace. I grew up in boarding school overseas. I moved to the US, finally when I was about 17. And there is something that is very weird about growing up in boarding school. I actually think that I thrived in it. My disease certainly did. My sexuality absolutely did. But it is a great place for isolators. It is a great place for people who want to tuck in by themselves. It's a great place to find dark corners. It's a great place to binge because there is a lot of structure and zero structure. It's like Lord of the Flies and then my boarding school. That's pretty much how, my adolescence was, but I learned a lot. A lot of it good, most of it not. But I've always had this presence of God, especially being forced to go to so many schools and services. And faith for me felt, it felt like shame, but in prettier packaging, if that resonates with anyone. So in my first few months of working this program and being in these rooms, the phrase God as you understand him just landed really flatly. I wanted to grasp it. I couldn't. I was struggling with the platitudes. It just felt very disingenuous. And I pretty much resigned myself early on that I wasn't going to find anything that was going to spiritually fill me in Overeaters Anonymous. I was going to get the plan. I was going to work the plan. And when I worked the plan, I was going to achieve what I wanted to achieve, and then I would be done. And that's not what happened, right? Because Overeaters Anonymous is sneaky. Grace can slide in sideways. And I found grace in this program. I found grace from your laughter. I found grace from the hugs that I recoiled from in the beginning. I found grace from your stories. And then I realized that God may have taken my mother, but he gave me all of these big sisters. Our rooms, I've been here now 15 years. And I can say that our rooms have not changed me. But it has reminded me, and it continues to remind me. It continues to show me with every meeting that I go to, face-to-face meeting I go to, that I was already worthy. I just had to be broken open. Maybe God wasn't punishment. Maybe God just meant some presence. And not like a gift present, like presence here with me. So, about my fourth year of abstinence, I'm an Eagle Boy Scout, actually something I achieved. And I went on a retreat with a couple of other Eagle Boy Scouts up to Washington State. And there's this beautiful lake called Diamond Lake. It's on the Washington-Idaho border. And I was there for a week and it was a silent retreat. And that in my fourth year of abstinence, in my fourth year of listening to all of you, in my fourth year of doing some service. You know, someone said yesterday or earlier today, just stuck in the chairs. That's what I did, you know, made the tea. It took me 4 years to find my higher power in this program. And it was during this retreat. So we were repairing trailheads by day. And, you know, my dad has this saying that character is who you are when no one else is watching, right? So, like, I think of him often, you know, when I'm lathering up my hair in the shower or, you know, when I'm driving, especially on a long stretch, you know, when there's no one else around me. And when I am alone with my thoughts, there is nowhere to run. And that is where I met Adam. So Adam is my chosen name for God. And I'm going to walk you through. Adam is a great guy. He is a loving authority figure in my life who is way bigger than myself. Adam is an authority figure. So there's the first A, right? He is an authority figure that is bigger than anything that my fear can create. He's bigger than anything my ego can create. He is designated. That man holds my will. He holds my life. He holds my love. He holds my heart. I ask him every day to melt the hardness and the heaviness of my heart, and he achieves that. He is available. I can reach him anytime. Say a quick prayer, seek a little bit of a pause, get a hug from one of you women. That's Adam talking to me through you. And he maintains. He holds my abstinence. He holds my sanity. And through him, I know that that is ultimately where I'm going to find my serenity. So my God does not demand things of me. He doesn't test. He stays. And that's what I need more than anything else. I need a presence that's going to stay. Because my history is the exact opposite. Right? And this is not the God of the thunderclaps in the sky. It's just, it's this little quietness that's in between all of the moments of my life. And if nothing else, I really hope that you all have the opportunity to sink those little moments of pause, because they can be profound when we work this program. He has never once told me that I'm unworthy. He tells me I'm afraid, and he's right. And he can hold that. My relationship with my higher power is the opposite of my disease. Right? Where food isolates me, God connects me. Where shame condemns me, God comforts me. And where I hide, and I do love to hide, I love to ghost, that's where God's waiting for me. God doesn't shout at me, y'all. Y'all, oh my God. What? That's a kick. He waits patiently until I am ready to listen, right? And that's Adam. And I hope that you all have a beautiful higher power that's as gracious and loving as mine is. That said, I'm still human. And I have instincts. And these are instincts that are born out of trauma, right? My first instinct is to perform and to try and charm, to manage your perception of me, and to be whatever I think that you need or I think that you think that I need. It's very exhausting. But it's not about the first instinct. It's about the second action, right? So again, I'm seeking that pause. And my recovery program has taught me that I don't have to obey that first instinct. It's the second action that I need to prevent. And so I pause, pray, sometimes a little bit longer, and then I choose again. And even 15 years in, my disease is loud, but my recovery is persistent. My first instinct is rarely my best instinct. And so that's why I pause. My first instinct is to lie. And the lie usually sounds like, I'm fine. Right? I'm reminded of going in on a Monday morning after binging. But before I could go in, because my housekeeper would come on Monday. See, that's really good planning for a binger. My housekeeper would come in on Monday, but before the housekeeper, I have to do the pre-clean. And the pre-clean means get rid of the evidence. So I am the type of binger where I would go to, you know, ye old golden arches. And after my binge food, I wouldn't crumple up and throw away the wrapper, because that takes up a lot of space. But if I fold it out flat, and if I stack up the containers, they are easily more, or they can be disposed of more easily. That is my insanity. So I would have to do a pre-clean, which was probably about 2 or 3 in the morning to get ready so that my housekeeper would never see the evidence. Except on a Monday when I benched myself so hard that I just slept and she came in to my house and she saw all of it. How long do you think I kept that housekeeper? No, that was her last time there. My first instinct is to isolate. What do I do today? Pick the phone. It is my 9th favorite tool of recovery. And I do it. My first instinct is to fix you. And now I've got really healthy boundaries and you can fix yourself. My first instinct is always to fall into fear. And God reminds me that fear is not fatal. It's just information. It's just sonar that's pinging back to me. OA gives me the space between the impulse and the action. And that is the space where God lives. There are some men in the room. So I wanna speak to the men. For most of my life, I really believed that intimacy was equal to danger. And if you saw me, if I let you in, you would inevitably leave me. And if I was vulnerable around you, then I could be used. And so, not allowing myself to feel my feelings, I packed on the weight. And it was an armor. The human body is an amazing thing. My body did exactly what I wanted it to do. I packed on the weight to hide myself so no one could ever find me. I flinched at hugs. I still do. I don't like hugs. I'm not a hugger. Y'all are some hugging people down here. And I'm just in acceptance that it's going to happen. And now I've said that at the group level, and I'm probably going to get more. But again, you're all my sisters, so it's kind of cool too. But I mistook attention for affection, and I mistook sex for safety. And if someone said that they loved me, I knew that some sort of betrayal was around the corner. And so I encourage you, it is really difficult to be a man and work this program. Allow yourself to be vulnerable, and you will be amazed at what gets broken in a good way. Intimacy, it's not exposure. It's just honesty. And honesty is the backbone of my abstinence. In our rooms, I found people who didn't flinch. 90% of you. I found people who don't try to fix me. People who don't try to diagnose me. You people in the rooms have provided the best service in one key area. You just stayed. You came all the way in. You sat all the way down and you stayed for me. Always shows me that intimacy is not dangerous. Vulnerability, it's not dangerous. It is sunlight and it is oxygen, and that in itself is divine. So, what my life is like now, if my 23-year-old, what the frick are you doing in Oklahoma City? But if my 23-year-old self could see me, I have so much compassion for him now. I really do. I love him to death. I'm amazed at what this program has given me. I've been abstinent every day that I've been a member of this fellowship. I've never accomplished anything like that. Nothing that I've accomplished in my life is more important than that. Without my abstinence, I've got nothing. Nothing. I'm married. I've got businesses. I hold elected office. I do things for people. I'm of service. And I'm someone who can look in the mirror and genuinely like the person who's looking back. And that doesn't make me special. It just shows that I'm surrendered. And some days I feel deeply spiritual, and some days I just don't take a compulsive bite, and I get to hold both of those things equally. Abstinence is not about perfectionism. It's just about having an availability and a willingness. It is about seeing things from a perspective that is different than what we have been inherently taught. We are not saints. We claim spiritual progress, not perfection. My recovery is not measured in pounds, although I'm very vain, so it kind of is. But I have worked like hell to remove every one of those 160 pounds. I have stitches on my body from contouring and fat removal because I'm vain. My recovery is not measured in the pounds that I have lost, but in the peace that I have gained from working this program. in moments that I don't react in the apologies that I've made, sometimes as soon as the shit is spilled out of my mouth, the gratitudes that are whispered instead of all of the gripes that are shouted. Owen gives me a life where I can live and not just perform at living. So I don't think that my story is special, but I do believe that it is sacred. I didn't lose everything, but I damn nearly did lose myself in the process, right? Pain is not a competition for me. It's just this weird collection point. It's just this roadside show that I had to go through. I come from a line of silence and secrets. I am the only child of only children. That is the family tree. What is a family Christmas? I don't know. But today I speak. I am not silent today. I believe that my abstinence is breaking this weird generational curse of my family. Mostly because my abstinence, it doesn't change me here in this moment in a silo. It has this really amazing ripple effect on everyone in this room. And that's what you're going to hear throughout this weekend. Everyone sharing their stories. And like someone was talking about the pieces of a puzzle in the assembly today, it's going to become a beautiful mosaic. My absence changes me, and it changes everyone around me. Every day that I draw a sober breath, I have an opportunity to grow. And in those breaths, I have an opportunity to see God again. So, are there any newcomers that are here?
Oh, yeah. My friends, you are the most important people in the room tonight. I'm just a bump on a log. You do not have to hit a new bottom in order to rise in this program. You do not have to perform in order to belong in this program. You do not have to disappear in order to be safe in OA. No one here is too far gone. Myself mostly, I am not too far gone. This disease, it does not care what I weigh. Neither do we. So again, please come all the way in, sit all the way down. And the phrase that I love the least, we will love you until you can love yourself. That is the hardest thing for me to hear. So I'm going to wrap up by saying, this is not the saddle and giddy up thing that I'm sure that a lot of y'all expected. But I realize, and what I bring tonight is sharing at a group level, that I realize that I have had a hard life and that I deserve better. I pray every day for God to continue to melt the hardness and heaviness of my heart. I seek guides in my life. And I anticipate that some of them are going to be different than what I'm expecting. Mostly from the people. And I commit to sanity at all costs because I know, my family, that that is ultimately where I am going to find serenity. My name is Jeremiah, and I'm a food addict. Thank you.